Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to begin by connecting with our friend, Bishop Thomas, Bishop Daniel Thomas, of the Diocese of Toledo. The USCCB designates October as Respect Life Month. Toledo Bishop Daniel Thomas is calling on Catholics to be agents of hope. Now, he doesn't say this in a vacuum. He's drawing from the reality of this Jubilee year, which we shouldn't forget. We should keep it at the forefront of our minds, that this really is the Jubilee of hope. And so this month, being Respect Life Month, ought to be a time when we cling to hope evermore. Bishop Thomas and I will be talking about how the position of life, the position of the gospel of life, is one of tremendous hope, and any other position tends to breed anxiety, worry, depression, and because it is a gospel of death, it breeds death in the soul. To cling to the gospel of Jesus Christ is to receive life and life in abundance. And so being a warrior for life in the womb becomes a testimony to what the cost of life is, but also what the joy of life can look like. I want to draw to your attention to that end that just this past week, the Guttmacher Institute released new data from its monthly abortion provision survey. There are some victories here. The data says that there's been a drop in the number of abortions. The Guttmacher Institute attributes this to Florida's recent heart bill law that's gone into effect. But there's a lot more to be done for the sake of fighting for the unborn, especially with the eradication right now of on-demand abortion pills, which need to be taken off the market for the harm that it's causing to life in the womb, but also to mothers who are not receiving medical care. We go on from there to then speak with John U. Bacon. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. I want to make this clear. Despite the fact that many of our listeners right now don't come from Michigan, didn't grow up in Michigan, like me, I grew up in Malaysia, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald is an event of global significance. Their plight, their moral virtue, their work ethic, and I guess to that end, more importantly, their death, should be a moment of American history that causes us to pause and ponder the progress of industry and the cost of human life. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, October 6th. It's the Feast of St. Bruno. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. Pope Leo has signed the first apostolic exhortation of his pontificate. The official text of the document will be released this week and is reportedly expected to focus on the poor. A New Jersey man has been arrested near the Cathedral of St. Matthew in Washington, D.C. on charges of unlawful entry, threats of kidnapping, and possession of a Molotov cocktail. Authorities identified the man as 41-year-old Luis Jerry. Officials say they learned that Jerry had been banned from the cathedral, but the department didn't specify the reason. After Jerry refused to leave, he was placed under arrest without incident. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy was at Newark Liberty Airport today and saying that air traffic controllers are more stressed than ever due to the federal government shutdown.
I want to be clear. Do I think they're more stressed right now in our towers? Yes. Is our airspace unsafe? No. Right? If we think there's issues in the airspace, we will shut it down.
Duffy spoke to air traffic controllers when he arrived and said they're worried about whether they'll get a paycheck next week. Rescue efforts are ongoing at Mount Everest, where some 200 people are stranded. Heavy snow that started Friday left hundreds trapped on the eastern face of the world's tallest mountain. The Supreme Court will take up some controversial cases in the new term that begins today. On the docket will be cases involving the use of race in congressional redistricting, conversion therapy for minors, and state laws banning transgender athletes in girls' sports. The High Court will also hear cases involving the Trump administration, including the legality of President Trump's global tariffs and whether Trump can fire Democratic-appointed officials without cause. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. October, designated by the USCCB as Respect Life Month. Toledo Bishop Daniel Thomas joins us, calling upon us to be Catholics as agents of hope. As I've mentioned, Bishop Daniel Thomas is the Bishop of the Diocese of Toledo. He also chairs the USCCB's Commission on Pro-Life Activities. Bishop Daniel Thomas, what a joy to reconnect with you. How are you?
Dr. Marcus Peter, great to connect with you and all the listeners, and so good to be with you in this Respect Life Month. Delighted.
And how wonderful that it's not just Respect Life Month, but also the month of the Holy Rosary. And it's no coincidence. So if you could enlighten us as to the wondrous connection between the intercession of our Blessed Virgin Mother as a mother and this need for pushing for the respect of life.
Sure. Well, thank you so much. And I have a special devotion to Our Lady of the Rosary in this month because our diocese, it's our patronal feast in the Diocese of Toledo. And the title of our cathedral, Marcus, is Our Lady, Queen of the Most Holy Rosary. So tomorrow evening, we actually have Sean Cardinal O'Malley here as the celebrant of our Mass. And it's a diocesan-wide feast day, so we really do look to that. Of course, the reality, as you and I know, in the very Gospel itself, we hear right after Mary receives the message of Gabriel, that she will be the mother of God, and she offers her fiat, her yes to that life in her womb, we have the witness, which is one of the most extraordinary things that every pro-lifer points to, and that is the meeting of Elizabeth and Mary in the visitation, and the actual leaping for joy in the womb of John the Baptist at the closeness of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So the reality of the human person of Jesus, fully human, fully divine, receiving a body in the womb of Mary and being recognized from the womb of Elizabeth by John the Baptist. It's an extraordinary witness to the life that is to come into the world that already exists fully in Mary's womb.
I want to ask if from there you could also speak to, so when the last time we had you on, we talked about the letter you wrote, The Body Reveals the Person, and it was such a hopeful version of the message compared to the secular ideology that's out there about human sexuality. Now, in that light, when we talk about Respect Life Month, and this being the Jubilee of Hope, the gospel of life is the only hopeful solution to an otherwise death-inducing lie.
Yes, and I think the reality that I tried to bring across, Marcus, in my letter, which is the body reveals the person, the Catholic response to gender ideology, is that created by God in his image, the bodies of all men and women are in and of themselves good. So the body created in God's image is holy, it is to be honored, and it is not to be treated as something to be manipulated. So the fact that Jesus himself came to us in humility, in a human body, he sanctified for all of us and for all eternity the human body.
Right. And the life, death, and resurrection, I'm drawing from your statement about Respect Life Month, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ has completely transformed the horizon of human life and existence. And that's why life in the womb has this wondrous dignity.
That's right. And of course, we know that the life in the womb, we are so it's so evident to us that it is a source of great hope. We speak of that when women are pregnant, right? And we talk about the hoped for grace and blessing of a new child coming into the world. It's just very, very natural for us. And the fact that, you know, in the Jubilee Year of Hope, we hear those words from St. Paul, hope does not disappoint. And for us as Catholics, hope has a name, and hope is a person. That person is Jesus Christ.
Right. And that is not only a tremendously powerful and profound statement, it is the complete grounding of the Christian faith, that ours is not a doctrine we profess that is dead letter, but it is completely grounded on a person, God, the Son of God, who took on the fullness of human nature. And again, that changes everything we can speak about in terms of human dignity.
Exactly. And I write in my Respect Life Month statement, Marcus, that through Christ, our sins are forgiven, death is overcome, life is victorious, and despite all the violence that we have seen in the headlines and on social media in these last weeks, despite these realities, it's for us to proclaim the gift of human life exists as a sign of hope to our world today, defying the powers of darkness and the culture of death, which is so prevalent.
Right. And that culture of death drawing from a tremendous place of darkness, you highlight in your statement that the headlines constantly bombard us with this consistent narrative that there is very little to no hope. And what it does is it shows us the sheer desperation of a world who needs to hear the reproclamation of the gospel.
And I think the reality that even though those who would believe or even be agents of such darkness, they don't even know, Marcus, that they themselves are thirsting for the hope that only God can provide. And we know that all of that darkness simply cannot and will not overcome us, because Jesus is our hope. And that darkness is, what does Jesus say? We know from John's gospel, that darkness came into the world, but that it did not overcome.
And because of that, Your Excellency, you and I can firmly say that the light of Christ is what we proclaim this month. To respect life is to respect the God who entered into the frailty of human life.
That's exactly right. And in that frailty, imagine that he allowed himself to be humbled in such a way that he himself needed to be cared for and nurtured. And we know that, one of the arguments against abortion is, of course, that every child, abortionists would say, well, if the child or the person can't take care of themselves, then they can be eliminated. That's true also, for example, of assisted suicide for the frail elderly. But we know that babies cannot take care of themselves, and so they have to be nurtured and cared for. And that's all part of recognizing the gift of human life. The fact that Jesus himself needed to be nurtured and cared for as a little tiny baby and an infant, and into his growth into a young child, that itself tells us how great hope is, because he allowed himself to become weak for our sake from the beginning, from the incarnation, and then, of course, again at the end, allowed himself to become weak, even taking on all of our sins to the cross.
And so, from a pragmatic perspective, you gave thanks to God by means of the prayers of Catholics across the nation for the defunding of Planned Parenthood, and you're calling now for a doubling down of prayer so that all taxpayer-funded abortion throughout the nation will be ceased.
That's right, because obviously we don't agree that people should pay to take the lives of the most innocent, the most vulnerable, the most defenseless, and that is babies in the wombs of their mothers. So we don't believe taxpayer funding should support that.
Right.
And of course, the reality is that abortion businesses like Planned Parenthood have been going to court to, stop the new law about federal Medicaid, paying for these things, and they stopped it for a year. Our hope is it might be ongoing beyond 1 year.
Your Excellency, we're running out of time. As a final word, as a spiritual father to all of us, a rousing cry to your children of why we should embrace this call once again.
Well, I think as children of the Father, as sons and daughters in the Son, who is Jesus, we have been given through baptism the power and the grace of living our lives in him. And so, Pope Leo says how important that every baptized person feel himself or herself called by God to be a sign of hope in the world today. And that's my hope, literally, that we will be those signs of hope living as witnesses to the gospel of life.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Bishop Daniel Thomas of the Diocese of Toledo. Pray for life this whole month of October. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Underwritten in part by this not-for-profit.
Hi, this is Mike Ditka.
Hey, this is Brian May.
Hi, I'm Chris Farley. You're listening to the Kevin Matthews Show.
I thought he was insane. A lot of people thought he was insane.
Nobody could touch us. We had 10 million people listening to us a week.
That was my past. If you would have told me I'd be carrying around a broken statue of the Virgin Mary, talking about God, I'd say, are you high?
Broken Mary, the Kevin Matthews story. In theaters one day only on Tuesday, October 7th. Tickets at BrokenMaryFilm.com.
On the next Epiphany.
Hi, Vanessa Denha-Garmo here. Deacon Mike Houghton will join me to tell us all about the 32nd Annual Mass for Commerce taking place October 22nd at Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit. And Terry Sue Monarch from Endow will talk about True Genius, a new Catholic formation program for middle school girls.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Vita. I am joined by John U. Bacon, whose recent book, The Gales of November, is a telling saga, or I should say a modern retelling, of the Edmund Fitzgerald disaster. And for those of us who live in Michigan, grew up in Michigan, this is a disaster that holds an emotional place in the historical memory of Michigan. Joining me, as I mentioned, is the author, John U. Bacon. He is a best-selling author, award-winning public speaker, commentator, college instructor, and hockey coach. And most recently, the interviewee here. I'm a fan. I really am. I read the book, and I'm just blown away by it. So I greatly encourage you to get a copy as soon as you have it, The Gales of November. So, John, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you very much. Love being here. I'm an old friend of Al Cresta's. So I've been on your show, boy, 3, 4, 5 times. And I've got good news. Your listeners read books. I can prove this.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad for the evidence, because that really is one of the hallmarks of this program. We talk about a lot of books, and if we're not specifically talking about the book, we're drawing from content from good books to begin with. So that definitely is something I believe marks a lot of the listeners of this program. So I want to start by touching on the personal reality that undergirds the book. And you put this in the introduction as well, that growing up in Michigan, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald was something that informed your historical memory. And so you have a psychological, emotional tie as well as an historical interest in the matter.
I do, and your wife is from Ann Arbor, so yeah. I guarantee you the song is in her head as well.
The song's in my head right now.
There you go. And we'll get to the song shortly, but if you grew up here in the Great Lakes, I mean, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ohio, any of them, you spend your summers on the beach, you spend your summers on Lake Michigan or Lake Erie or Lake Huron. I've been to all those lakes. So it's kind of part of the background of your life, basically. So we see these big old ships go by, but frankly, we don't know very much about them.
Right. We really don't. And in fact, until reading your book, I didn't quite realize that there's a dynamic that goes on in terms of the aqua dynamics, the flow of water, the hogging and sagging, as you rightly describe, mm-hmm. and therefore the corresponding length of ships. All of that was really intriguing for me to find out. So for the sake of our listeners, especially those who are not accustomed to the Great Lakes, it's a stunning experience.
Here are a few facts that your listeners will appreciate, especially those not from the Great Lakes. But even I, who grew up around them, I got to tell you, I asked my wife, the other books I've written about hockey and football and so on, take me about a year. Why did this one take me 4 years? My wife said, that's easy. You didn't know anything. So here I am. But here's a few facts for you. One, how big are these lakes?
Mm-hmm.
If you combine the five lakes, which are Huron, Ontario, Michigan, Erie, and Superior, HOMES is the acronym,
yep.
The surface areas of those lakes is greater than Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and the state of New York. In other words, all of New England in the United States,
yep.
and the state of New York. These things are gigantic. They're inland seas.
Yep.
So that's one thing you got to realize. When you're in the middle of these lakes, you can't see either side. And not because of the mist, because the curvature of the earth makes it impossible.
Yep.
So these things are gigantic. People don't often realize that unless you're from here. Two, the water, as you pointed out. Salt water on the oceans smashes down the waves, makes them nice and soft on top,
mm-hmm.
and spreads them out. So they come every 10 to 16 seconds on the oceans. They come every 4 to 8 seconds on the Great Lakes. They come twice as fast, and they're not smooth, they're pointy, because there's no salt water
right.
to smash them down. So what you have is a mountain range coming at you twice as fast with sharp, nasty water about to crash down on your ship. Why does that matter? Because these ships are so long, they're 700 feet long,
mm-hmm.
and now they're 1,000 foot long. You can have your bow in one 30-foot wave, nothing in the middle, and your stern in another 30-foot wave with nothing supporting it. That's
yep.
when sagging happens.
That's right.
Ships have been known to crack between
right.
waves. I had no idea about any of this. Let me throw in one more while we're at it, and that is that on the oceans, the storms can come from 1,000 miles away. You grew up in Kuala Lumpur,
yep.
of course. You know what I'm talking about. If there's an earthquake underneath, the typhoon happens.
Well, we were very spoiled in Malaysia. We had no natural disasters, but we heard about it, you know, Philippines, Indonesia, the surrounding countries.
Exactly. So out there, it can happen thousands of miles away.
Yep.
And by the time they get to you, they've been softened also. In the Great Lakes, the storm is right above your head.
Wow.
It's localized. And when it gets nasty, it gets very nasty and very quickly. So there's almost no warning. So for all these reasons, when I talk to commercial sailors who've sailed on both the Great Lakes and the ocean, John Hayes, for example, 23 years in the Great Lakes, 12 on the Atlantic Ocean, he said, it's not even close. And anybody who's sailed both will tell you the Great Lakes are far more dangerous than the ocean. I couldn't believe it. But each time I talked to a commercial sailor, they told me the same thing. Guys have sailed both. So that was news to me.
Right. And in fact, until reading this book, all of what you mentioned was news to me as well. And that really gives you at least a visual, an imaginative representation of the concerns that one has navigating the waters of the Great Lakes. And yet, this is work that needs to be done. And so that's what the crew of the Edmund Fitzgerald was attempting to accomplish.
Exactly right. I also didn't realize how much we relied
yes.
on Great Lakes shipping.
Which, I didn't realize.
Well, and I live here. Shame on me, right? But anyway, so all the rest of you are excused. But around the world, because the cement in your basement, the steel in your car, the cereal on your table, the wheat and so on, the
yeah.
limestone, the lumber, of course, almost all of that comes from the Great Lakes. Chances are, wherever you live in the world, you have received Great Lakes goods.
That's right. And you've received, especially in developed parts of the world, you've received something that has passed by the Great Lakes, which is another thing that, for those of us who live in areas surrounding the Great Lakes, we take for granted. And so the kind of commerce, the kind of shipping that takes place there is life-threatening and yet necessary for the developed world, for the civilized world.
That's a good way to phrase it. So the developed world, definitely, they want the steel, they
yep.
want the
cement,
the cement and so on. But the undeveloped world, the U.S. is by far the biggest a trader of wheat and corn.
That's right.
Germany is second with half as much. And where does it come from? It comes from not only the states surrounding the Great Lakes, but Kansas and Iowa are close enough, they train that stuff into Chicago, into Milwaukee, and that gets on a ship and goes everywhere in the world.
Yep. And so that gives us then context for understanding the Great Lakes. And you also write about your personal experience when some of the first few times you saw the Great Lakes. I actually like the way you wrote about it. So in your own words, if you could describe that as well.
in terms of, sorry.
When you saw the Great Lakes, your first experience of the Great
absolutely.
Lakes.
Absolutely. You don't know how big they are. They were fun to frolic in. It seems like, hey, this is a great party we're having here. But you look across the lake and you can't see the other side.
Right.
Then you see these ships go by, and I was oblivious as to what's on those ships.
Mm.
You see them go by all the time. I have no idea. And one of my friends, former Great Lakes Maritime Academy superintendent, he said, we know the farmer, the miner, the factory worker. Nobody knows the sailor. And I thought about that. Why is that? Because there are only 9,000 of them, 300 ships times 30 people per ship. And guess what? They're not home. 9 months out of the year, they're on a ship. It's a very hard life for a family. You're home December, January, February, March, basically. So you're not running the Rotary Club. You're probably not in church.
Yep.
Because you're on church and on a ship.
Yep.
You're not running the Little League team. And one of the guys I got to know, he said, I've got 3 kids. I didn't teach any of them how to ride a bike or throw a baseball. And that's, as a father myself, heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's a hard, hard life.
Yeah. And these men do this so that the rest of us can have goods that we take for granted.
They are heroes before the ship went down. That's my phrase on that one.
Yep, exactly. And that was a beautiful way to phrase it. And so your book then touches on the event of 1995, the families gathering.
1975.
This is the gathering.
I'm sorry, you are correct.
No, go ahead.
It's my book, and you knew it better than I did, yes.
Well, I read
we started out talking about 1995 when they bring the bell up for the first time. And that's no small trick when the ship is 530 feet below the surface. That is a 53-story building, basically. They decided,
no small feet, my goodness.
Oh, you need to know what you're doing. And even then, it's dangerous. So they brought they cut welded the old bell and brought it up. And they have polished that. That is now at the Whitefish Point Museum. It's the closest point to where they were going. And they put back another bell with the men's names engraved on it to let people know these are the 29 men. So, and that brought the families together. The crew was very close in this ship. The families didn't know each other at all because they're living in Duluth, Minnesota, or Toledo, Ohio, 700 miles away. And this effort to bring the bell up and to declare it a national gravesite brought these families together, and they're still close to this day. So that is one consolation for this horrible tragedy.
We're continuing this conversation on the other side of the break with Dr. John Eubacon. He's a best-selling author, and most recently the author of The Gales of November, this wonderful retelling of the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them, so you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
This week on Christ is the Answer, we continue Father John's RCIA for Catholics series. Over the years of pastoring a church, Father John noticed that converts to Catholicism almost always seemed to know their newly found faith much better than their cradle Catholic brothers and sisters. So he put together an RCIA for Catholics series. Join us this week as Father John talks about Luke 11:1 and how to pray like Jesus taught. Tune in for Christ is the Answer Monday through Fridays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Hello, Steve Ray here from Footprints of God Pilgrimages. The land of our Lord and our Lady is calling us. We're heading back to the Holy Land over Christmas break this year. We have the best, most reliable guides and services awaiting us. The holy sites are open, and the local Christians are anxious to see us. Galilee, Jerusalem, Nazareth, Bethlehem. No crowds, no lines. Hope you can join us.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
The headlights of my father's station wagon briefly penetrated the thick black of the piney woods through which we drove on our way to Mag and Jim's cabin. When we arrived, my father handed the two wrapped plates of Thanksgiving dinner to Mag, who sat on the front porch next to a smudge pot. I followed my father into the cabin to a back room, where Jim lay on an old iron bed. Jim's form, after a long battle with cancer, was barely visible under the sheet. The bare room lacked electricity. Occasionally I could see the twinkle of a star through a small hole in the tin roof. My father sat at the edge of the bed, talking with Jim. I remember one thing Jim said. The Lord, He'd been so good to me. In all his illness and poverty, Jim saw the goodness of God. What a contrast to the woman who in a Lincoln Navigator pulled up to the abortion clinic and announced to me, "This baby gotta go." GuadalupeWorkers.org.
The Wine Palace in Livonia is a proud sponsor of Ave Maria Radio. The Wine Palace is a family-owned business for over 60 years where customers come in for a great service. The 9,000-square-foot store includes a humidor, specialty wine room, and a rare and collectible spirits room. We have the largest selection of spirits in the state at the most competitive prices. Ask for one of the brothers, Cliff or Kelly, and thank them for their strong support of Catholic Radio. Delivery is available. Please visit the Wine Palace at I-96 in Middlebelt or at winepalacemi.com.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with John Newbacon, who is the author, best-selling author, of The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Please do procure a copy. I greatly enjoyed reading it. It really is a delightful read, and it's a wondrous way to connect both mentally in terms of the historical narrative, but also emotionally to the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And so, John, I want to pick up where we left off. One of the figures that you bring up immediately at the beginning of the book is Captain Ernest McSorley.
Yes.
And I just want to put this out there. Internationally, sometimes there's a misconception that him, as well as the crew, were rookies who didn't quite know what they were doing. That is far from the truth.
Marcus, well done. It is the exact opposite. Of the 300 ships on the Great Lakes, this was considered Titanic. The best ship, for a long time, the longest ship. One of the fastest ships, held the most cargo, broke all the cargo records that it itself set for 13, 14 years. The captain, Ernest McSorley, was considered by all accounts, even by current sailors I've talked to from around at that time. He was the best captain on the Great Lakes, and his crew was also the best because you wanted to get on this ship. They had the best food. That's something. They had air conditioning, which no one had air conditioning.
Which is a big deal.
Absolutely.
Especially at the time.
Oh, my gosh. In the 50s and 60s, unheard of. Carpeted, you know, recreation areas, right. Tiled bathroom floors. These were luxuries
right.
Back then. So you wanted to get on that ship, and you wanted to stay on that ship. So they had, and again, the guys from the other ships, like the Arthur Anderson, that sailed alongside it mm-hmm. that last night, they said, look, we had a great crew. They had a better crew.
Right.
He was the best captain, the best crew. So any notion these guys were knuckleheads, idiots, inexperienced, right. is the opposite is the truth.
Yeah.
In fact, 5 of the 29 guys, all in their 50s and 60s, were going to retire after this last run. It adds to the tragedy. One of those was Ernest McSorley,
yeah.
who added one more run to get the bonus so he could pay for his wife's health care. She had, I believe, cancer and needed additional care, and that was what he was going to do. And then retired home with her in 3 days. So the heartbreak is tremendous.
It truly is. And some of those people that you mentioned were also veterans. They
yes.
You know, please talk about that a little bit.
Well, he was 63 years old. Three-quarters of the crew out of 29 were in their 50s and 60s. These
right.
guys were World War II vets.
Yep, exactly.
They'd survived the Great Depression. They'd served usually very honorably with medals and so on in World War II. So that's one generation about to retire. Then you got 6 guys between 20 and 22, long hairs, lamb chops, the whole bit, who are trying to avoid Vietnam, a very different
right,
mindset.
Right.
But under McSorley...
Avoid Nam and look like the Beatles.
Exactly. If I had that line a year ago, Marcus, that would be in the book. That's a good one. Appreciate that. Classic. But they all got along very well. Under McSorley, the young guys and the old guys got along very well. Also, the guys in the engine room,
yeah,
below deck in the back, versus the guys in the pilot house, above deck in the front. It's like offense and defense on a football team,
yeah,
whether it's soccer or American football. They tend not to get along. On this ship, they really did.
Mm.
They got along very well. And one of the guys said, I'm pretty sure McSorley had a very strict no-jerk policy.
And I could totally see that. Everything I know about him, based on reading this book and researching after the fact, this was a guy who was no-nonsense. He ran a tight ship quite
literally. Absolutely. Yeah, no-nonsense. And if you're a jerk or you weren't willing to, you know, couldn't do your job, weren't willing to do your job, you'd be off that ship pretty fast. Flip side is, as they all said, he was utterly fair. If you did your job and were fair to other people, he didn't care about much else. So
yeah,
if your hair's long and you're trying to avoid Vietnam, he didn't care. So long as it's not so long as it gets caught in the machinery.
Uh-huh.
That is one of his rules. These guys got along very well. He wasn't a very outgoing guy, but his crew would follow him from ship to ship. The loyalty was that intense.
November 10, 1975. A day that should go down, at least in Michigan, in for me. So tell us about the storm, this great white storm, this just understanding that the crew knew what they were up against.
I've got a chapter in the book on the storm of the century,
yep,
1913. And I call it that because it's not going to hold the title for a whole century. It gets bumped by November 10th, 1975. Three things happen at once. One, it's 70 degrees in Duluth, Minnesota that day. That's never the case on November 9th in Duluth. So winter has not arrived. Here's a rule I did not know. The longer winter takes to arrive, the angrier it shows up. It's like water behind a dam.
Uh-huh.
You want it to ease in slowly, not build up.
Right.
If you do it this way and it builds up, it crashes hard. So 70 degrees on Sunday, you're wearing T-shirts on deck. And within hours, you got a snowstorm going sideways right in front of your face. That's one problem. Second problem is the Alberta Clipper from Western Canada. Pretty typical storm, comes in with cold, dry air. What's not common is another storm comes up from the southwest of the United States with hot, wet air.
Mm.
Also furious wind. These three things combined right in front of Whitefish Bay on Lake Superior. That's basically home plate if you're a baseball fan. It sets up like a catcher, or in cricket. All right, there
I'm
you go.
A baseball fan.
There we go. Sets up like a catcher right in front of home plate, and now it's waiting for the Edmund Fitzgerald to arrive. The worst storm in a century. Waves of 40, 50, even 60 feet. Winds of 100 miles per hour. Those knock over cars, trailer parks.
Yeah.
It's bad, bad news.
So you've got November 10, 1975, which is this conglomeration of bad events, a kind of perfect storm of sorts.
It truly is.
But just generally, November for the shipping companies and the ships on the Great Lakes, they know it's a tremendously deadly month.
They do, and it comes from a Newsweek article written by Jim Gaines, and a line taken by Gordon Lightfoot, the famous singer, The
yep.
Gales of November. You'd rather be in the lakes in December, surprisingly, once winter's actually there.
Mm.
It's cold, it's not pleasant, but it's not dangerous, not as dangerous. November's the worst, because the water's still warm, and the air turns cold. When you boil water, what happens? When the water's hot and the air's not, the mist comes up, the steam comes up. Here it's fog and or waves. So the air is pulling waves up. You do not want to be in the lakes in November.
And yet, so in chapters 4 to 5 of your book, you talk about the great iron industry that was, and so it was driving American affluence forward. We needed this.
Yes.
And so, you know, the people on the Edmund Fitzgerald, but also every other ship on the Great Lakes, they were willing to take that risk.
They were, and for a few reasons. Them individually, these are guys who've been farmers and factory workers and miners who survived the Great Depression, whose dad might have lost their job at that time, survived World War II. You know what? Getting time and a half on a good union contract and good money, 3-4 times more than a teacher makes, to do hard work, but You're still looking at the lake and the northern lights and the great fall colors.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot better than a factory. So these guys were appreciative for their jobs,
yeah,
and we were appreciative for them because it's hard to believe now. when my region, where you live now, of course, is known as the Rust Belt.
Mm-hmm.
But from 1945 to 1975, it had all the power and prestige of Silicon Valley does today in San Francisco.
Yep.
This was the epicenter of the world's economy.
Yep.
And of the 100 biggest companies in the United States, which is really the world at that point, more than one-third directly revolved around Detroit. The auto companies, the tire makers, oil companies, steel companies, it all revolved around Detroit.
Man. And because of that, like you mentioned, all these industries made it so that this part of the world became a hub for raw material, especially steel.
Yes, steel, copper, limestone, which turns iron into steel. Of course, lumber, and if you want to go back 300 years, beaver pelts and otter skins, which they called soft gold. They made a lot of money on that in the 1600s. But yes, the raw materials, here's the catch. The raw materials are in the north, and on Superior, again, northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, UP of Michigan, but you have to get it to the south. That's Gary, Indiana, Chicago, Illinois, Detroit, Toledo, Cleveland. That's where the mills are, the factories are. So you have to transport all that stuff by ship to those factories.
Right. And so in this great industrial boom, you get the answer of a prolific businessman, Edmund Fitzgerald. Tell us about his vision.
There was a man behind it. He was the CEO of Northwestern Mutual Insurance, based in Milwaukee. Very nice guy by all accounts. His five great uncles were all Great Lakes captains. His dad is one of the best shipbuilders in the history of the Great Lakes.
Mm.
So it's not that crazy that he wanted to buy a ship, build one, basically. He had one rule. It has to be the greatest ship on the Great Lakes. And it was.
It was. It was. I'm talking with John Newbacon. He is the author of this gripping book. I mean that sincerely. I would greatly recommend you get a copy of it. And it's called The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. John is a best-selling author, award-winning public speaker, commentator, college instructor, and hockey coach. And normally he's also best known for his books on sports, business, but his historical books, gosh, it really is a gripping narrative. Continuing on the other side of the break, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Gather with local business professionals for a morning of inspiration at the Archdiocese of Detroit's 32nd Annual Mass for Commerce. Mass will begin at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, October 22nd at Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit, followed by a time of networking over a hot breakfast. A free will offering will be accepted at the event, or you can donate online when you register by clicking the events tab at aod.org. That's aod.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
How did the first community of believers in Jerusalem pray? The Catholic Catechism tells us that as Christ's disciples were gathered together on the first Pentecost, the Spirit of the promise was poured out on them. They were in one place, devoting themselves to prayer. The Holy Spirit came to teach the church, to recall for her everything Jesus said, and to form her in a life of prayer. The first community devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of the bread and prayers. This sequence is characteristic of church worship founded on apostolic faith, lived in charity, and nourished by the Eucharist. The faithful hear these prayers and read them in the Scriptures and make them their own, particularly the Psalms. Thus, the Holy Spirit keeps the memory of Jesus Christ alive in His church at prayer. He leads her to the fullness of truth. He also inspires new formulations to express the unfathomable mystery of Christ at work in His church. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm August Reed. I'm talking about John Newbacon, best-selling author, most recently of The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And lest we think that there's nothing to be told about the story, I'd be the first to say you're wrong. And this is a really gripping narrative. John, I want to pick up where we left off. So we're talking about the great industrial boom that America is seeing, especially this part, the Midwest. I'm going to be a little self-centered here in saying Michigan was, in fact, leading industry in the world, not just in the U.S., and shipping materials over the Great Lakes became pivotal to the development of that industry, and so Edmund Fitzgerald responds to it. In the building of the boat, though, one of the things that you highlighted, did he cut costs for safety?
I'm afraid so, and it's largely unbeknownst to him. The Great Lakes engineering work based in Detroit, even though the ship is owned by Milwaukee, they did cut some corners, and some aspects of the design they did not think would alter safety, but probably did. For example, new technology at the time, instead of building the entire ship in Detroit, they brought in three sections of it, all right, the bow, the stern, and the middle, and fused them together on the hull, on the hull plate. That is modular construction, which probably added more flexibility than they expected. They also, this is where they cut some corners, they thought that welds were going to be as strong as rivets. They're not.
Yep.
They're cheaper, they're faster to do, and they're lighter. You can save 1.2 million pounds by using more welds than rivets, which means 1.2 million more pounds of steel.
Yeah.
You can run across the Great Lakes every time you run 50 times a year. That's a considerable savings. More profit, of course, but it makes it more flexible. So when that ship is on the Great Lakes and it starts getting calm waters, no problem at all. When it gets 5, 10, 15-foot waves, as McSorley himself said to Craig Sullivan, who's still alive, one of my sources, when you're in something called a tunnel, and if you're claustrophobic, Marcus, do not get in the tunnel. It runs the length of the ship, 700 feet, not much bigger than a human being, right underneath the deck. You walk through this when the weather's too nasty to be on deck. The lights at the end of the ship would actually disappear at the end of the tunnel because it flexed so much.
Right.
3, 4, 5, 10 feet, you wouldn't be able to see the lights at the end of the tunnel. That's how limber this ship was.
God.
And it became more so when they changed the regulations to allow them to sink 3.5 more feet in the water than before. So it went from 14 feet above water to only 11 feet above water. It wasn't designed for that.
Right.
And so here you are in your 13th, 14th year, loading a lot more taconite, iron ore component. And that sets you up for danger.
Yeah.
On a calm day, you don't notice. But as one of my guys said, normally it doesn't matter until you're in a storm, and then it matters a lot.
Exactly. And your book highlighted that well, because like you mentioned, the boat, and therefore the crew, the captain, they all gained celebrity status.
Before it went down, which I didn't fully appreciate, this was, out of 300 ships, this was the rock star of the Great Lakes. And so is the captain. And
I didn't know that until
I didn't know there were rock stars on the Great Lakes. I grew up here, man. What's my excuse? But if you're going through Detroit or Port Huron, Michigan, Toledo, yeah. and especially the Sioux Locks, where you've got to slow down to go through this 21-foot depth change, they've got a bandstand, basically, where fans of the ship would get there hours in advance to cheer the ship on as it went through. And one of the guys on the ship said, "I'm sorry, we felt like rock stars. We really did." You'd get out there and wave your caps, and they'd cheer and take your photos.
Oh, boy. Gosh. And again, and what made me sad when I read all this, too, is I realized that such a culture is not something we could replicate today.
When I think about today versus then, look, 75 was a tumultuous time in the U.S., too. We're just getting out of Vietnam, finally. President Nixon has resigned under pressure. Watergate and so on. Gas prices are high. Inflation is runaway. I was 11 years old at the time, and I remember it was tumultuous. And yet, you look at the guys on the ship and how well they got along. And I guarantee you they did not share all the same politics.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? As one of the guys said, the choice here is very simple. Either we work together and we get home, or we don't and we die here.
That's right. That's right. One of the quotes in the book was, We have to get on the lake to do this work, but we don't have to get home.
I love that one. It's from the Coast Guard, and they passed it down. We have to go out. We don't have to come back.
Scary.
And they knew the risks inherent. And
yeah.
Here's a fact that you know. From 1875 to 1975, there were at least 6,000 commercial shipwrecks on the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
That's one per week for a month. That's 30,000 men, one a day. I'm sorry, one per week for a century. That's one a day for a century, one casualty a day, and it leads up right up to November 10th. These guys knew that they're in a risky, risky business.
Yeah. Tell us about the Plimsoll line.
Plimsoll line started by a man in Great Britain who was tired of seeing ships, coffin ships, would go down, and the owners would collect cynically mm-hmm. their insurance money, knowing that they put the guys' lives in grave danger.
Mm-hmm.
So it's now painted on all the ships as well as welded to make sure you don't move the paint.
Mm.
And that's how far your ship is allowed to sink in the water, fully loaded, and still be safe and be insured by Lloyd's of London or right. anybody else. And yet, they found very creative ways to cheat that line again and again and again until finally the U.S. government said, you can... In the Fitzgerald's case, instead of 14-some feet, drop it down to 11 feet. Take 3 feet off the limit. And they're just trying to shave an inch here and there. And an inch, by the way, will save you tons
yep.
of steel. That's 1 inch on these ships. So 3 feet is millions of dollars. And they made that money. And while they're doing that, though, as we said, the ship was not designed to be that low in the water.
Yeah. And because it wasn't, it was common at that time. Now, just to be fair to the Edmund Fitzgerald's crew, it wasn't just them.
Everybody.
Right.
They were told to do it. They did it. There are a lot of creative ways, it turns out, to cheat that line. When you put the pellets, the iron pellets, on the ship, these 500 million pellets, about marble-sized, on the ships, it's so hot that the middle of the ship will start sagging.
Yeah.
Because the steel gets warm and starts to bend.
Exactly, because malleable.
So you take the hoses, pulling up Lake Superior water, which is cold year-round, you spray it on the deck of the ship, and that bend goes out, and your ship comes up, and guess what? You're beating the Plimsoll line.
That's right, because now you're not at 14 feet anymore.
Exactly right.
When I read that, I thought, okay, that's a good use of physics. A bad use of physics, but a good use of physics.
They knew their stuff.
Tell us about the Toledo Express and its influence on industrial America.
This ship was more consistent than almost any other on the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
The nickname was the Toledo Express for this ship. They'd pick up taconite, iron ore, as I said, in Silver Bay, Two Harbors, or Duluth, Minnesota, usually. The last trip, Superior, Wisconsin, right next door. They'd go through Lake Superior, down the Sioux Locks, Lake Huron, Detroit, and land in Toledo, usually, and dump it all off. Takes 2.5-3 days. Then you're riding late all the way back to Minnesota, and you do it again 50 times a year.
You know, one good thing about reading this is it's unfortunate, and a lot of it has to do with the overt college culture that we have now that we seem to write off blue-collar work.
I like that.
No, but reading this, you get a sense of the work ethic, the integrity, the unity of the men for a common mission, but also embracing life-threatening situations for the sake of the work.
There's no question. And also, these guys were very smart guys.
Yes.
Now, some of these guys were 8th grade dropouts because if your dad dies when you're in 8th grade and you got 4 younger siblings, you're the dad.
Yep.
At 13. So that's the job you do. These guys were not complainers. But they would teach themselves at night engineering, meteorology, metallurgy, you name it, to pass all these very rigorous
right.
tests. Become a third engineer, a second engineer, a first engineer. And they would do that for their families. These guys were self-taught, largely. And very smart. Again, not educated in the normal sense.
Yeah.
But as you say, we tend to be so college-focused that we lose guys like this.
Yep. And, okay, so one of the things you highlight is the different ways in which they had to get certified. They had to get expertise for the sake of not just working on the boat, but sometimes doing the work for the boat.
Absolutely. And, look, you can't even get in the pilot house.
Right.
Unless you pass these rigorous tests where you know out of dozens of Great Lakes ports, the currents of all of them, where the breakwater is, how much space and depth you have in, again, 30, 40, 50 ports around the Great Lakes. And these guys knew that stuff in their heads because when you come in at 2 o'clock in the morning and it's dark and you got 10-foot waves, there's no time to check your math. You better know it.
Oh, boy. Which then brings us to the tragic finale, which is we have to sink the boat. November 8 to 10, 1975. I got to tell you, when I got to that part of the book, I started emotionally connecting with... It was different. I read about the event before when I was overseas. This was a different experience.
Well, most of our sections are 4 or 5 chapters. The section called The Last Run is 11 chapters because we realize you're going so fast through that, there's no point breaking it up.
Yeah.
That's the run. And it all happens, it all comes together at once, sadly.
Yeah.
The perfect storm, as you said earlier, in the worst place for the Edmund Fitzgerald, right in front of home plate, if you will. And it goes right into it, and more tragically, the captain was a go-go captain, very aggressive. Yet, on his last run of his life, it's going to be either way. He did two things he would never do normally. He took the northern route on Lake Superior, which adds 14 hours. It's supposed to be safer, but now you've given the storm a 14-hour head start.
That's right.
To get to Whitefish Bay, and you're going over terrain, water you don't know that well. He only does it once a year, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you go over a 6-fathom shoal, very shallow. They went over a leg that's 1,300 feet deep. This is 5, 10, 15, 20 feet deep in various places. Probably hits at that point.
Yep.
And then he waits 1 hour for the Arthur Anderson to catch up because his radars are out, the lighthouse is out, he's blind, and he's taking on water. So these are all rational moves, and yet they all probably, tragically, ironically, backfired in this situation.
Okay, John, down to the last 1 minute, and okay, so the boat has sank, but the legacy, the lessons that continue live on. I've got about 20 seconds of an exhortation.
Well, here, a church-going crowd, Mariners Church, Reverend Ingalls, goes out the next morning and rings the bell at Mariners Church. It's 4 sailors. Rings the bell 29 times. An Associated Press reporter sees this, passes it on. It's part of the story. And then part of the Newsweek story, and now it's part of the song.
Yeah.
Without the Reverend doing that and a witness watching that, I don't think the song gets written, and therefore there's no book. So on these small gestures of dignity and humanity and belief, the story lives on.
John, this was a true delight. My guest has been John U. Bacon, best-selling author, most recently of The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It is truly gripping and moving as a narrative. Do pick it up, and thank you for joining us. I'm Ox Peter.